everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Lara Romans. Before we begin, don't forget to leave a review and follow us. It really helps us keep making this podcast. You can also grab tickets for our next film club edition of Everything Everywhere All at Once on April 24th, coinciding with next week's episode on Hollywood comebacks. For this episode, Kiriko sat down with Dutch documentary filmmaker Luc Bouwman to discuss his latest film, De Propagandist. The documentary examines one of the most prolific yet largely forgotten figures in Dutch cinema history, Nazi propagandist Jan Teunissen. After his failed attempt to create the movie William of Orange, a Dutch equivalent to D.W. Griffith's racist epic Birth of a Nation, Teunissen found himself shut out by the Dutch film industry. But with the rise of the Nazi occupation, he seized an opportunity to fulfill his filmmaking ambitions. As head of propaganda film production for the NSB and the Dutch SS, working closely with people like Himmler and Goebbels, he became the most powerful Dutch filmmaker of the era, producing propaganda films that served the Nazi regime. After the war, he continued his work in a different form, shifting from political propaganda to advertising. In their conversation, Kiriko and Luc Bouwman discussed the role of filmmakers in shaping ideology, why the Netherlands has tried to erase Teunissen from its cinematic history, and how propaganda has evolved over time. Here's Kiriko to find out more.
Welcome, Luc.
Thank you.
So we start all of our interviews here at Celebrating Cinema by asking the question, what your first memory of film or cinema was?
Well, the first thing that pops to my mind is E.T., actually, just really being into the movie and I think also for the first time realizing that it was a movie because apparently there were no aliens around me. So that's one thing that the films of those years, I think also Jaws and really being scared to death and waking up in the middle of the night. So these kind of films, yeah.
Nice. The classics.
Yeah, the classics. And then I remember there were some projections, still 60 millimeter projections with educational films at my high school, in the elementary school still. And these were old films, and I do remember that I was kind of fascinated by the machinery and the man that was putting the film inside, and that suddenly you realize that, okay, this is something that somebody made and you projected. And
wow, they brought the projector to your school.
To my school, yeah. I think it was a really outdated system, but they would still do this once in a while. And there was one film about vandalism and trying to teach kids that they shouldn't vandalize things, but of course it worked the other way around, that everybody was cheering for for the vandals. Yeah. This was in Oss, where I grew up, where there were some issues with vandals.
Wow. How did your journey to go through it very quickly from your love for E.T. and Jaws and the other classics and the interest in the machinery go to you eventually deciding that you wanted to make films yourself as well?
I didn't want to make films until I was in art school, I think. I went to art school because I wanted to become a painter, and I did follow the painting courses for the first 2 years, and then I switched. But I think already in high school, I did discover like art house cinema and Kieslowski and even like French New Wave films. They were in the videotheque at that time, and so I was fascinated by those films and liked them, but also was quite sure that when I realized that you had to make every shot by itself and like the amount of work and the complexity involved was mind-blowing. And I think in art school what happened is that we had some really good teachers. We did get film classes, and they brought it down to just like other kinds of films, like art films, but also documentaries. And I remember being like really interested in these classical direct cinema films, and for the first time seeing the films of, for example, Salesman and these films, or of Maisel's Brothers and Frederick Wiseman, especially, that I was really like completely fascinated just by the films itself. And then I thought, okay, this is something that apparently you can do by yourself or with two people, and it didn't feel so overwhelming and so complex. And then started making my own, like my first films. Also what happened, I think I was interested in so many things like painting, but also writing and music. I was also playing in a band. And I think with film, I felt the opportunity to combine those things, like it is in the end also a medium where you can do all these things together. So making the first films, I think I felt really just interested in going forward with that. Yeah. Mm.
And was it then already in that time that you were still studying and experimenting in all these different fields that you were in a way discovering a further truth within reality? Because of course you ended up making documentary films, which is very different than fiction in some way. Was it already in those different art forms that you were trying to get closer to reality in some way?
What is still so powerful about these observational films is that reality itself is the mystery, like the ultimate mystery. And I remember looking at these films and just feeling the complexity of life itself in those films. And so I think that's just the fascination for what is happening. Why are we on this rock in a cold universe? And so that, I think that was why I became more and more interested in documentaries as opposed to films. I also remember this was a time when in the Netherlands, the films, you had this manifesto of the Fantasten. They called themselves the Fantasten. And I thought that was quite ridiculous that they wanted to make this fantasy movie, like saying we have to be more inventive in our minds and make and all kinds of wonderful stories. And when you look at these observational films, for me, that was so much more interesting. And but also something else, I think I was interested in this more like video art, and I did an internship with a Belgian director called Stéphane de Kostere, who was maybe coming out of postmodernism, but was making films also about representation and actually about the impossibility of making something realistic for television and really attacking television by programs that were dealing with television and with media and with the effects that media have on how we perceive reality. So that was the other side that I think when I was studying, I was very much attracted to this kind of work that was dealing with perception and with media itself and trying also to make my first programs in this direction. I remember one of the top philosophers at that time was Baudrillard, and I was just calling him up and asking if he wanted to be part of my film. And then he said, "What is it about?" And I tried to explain this like art school student concept. And then he was like, "What am I going to say?" And I told him, "No, that's up to you." And he said, no, that's up to you. It's always up to the filmmakers who decide what I am going to say." So, and he was right in a way. But I think after film studies at the art school, I just tried to find my way a little bit in between these two extremes of observational cinema and these films that were really about representation itself, and going a little bit back and forward between these two extremes.
Now you made a film about someone who is so important in our cinematic history. And I actually, after watching your film, I realized that I watched his film Shabbat at film school without realizing who he was. And I think it's a name that I had never heard of before or never really remembered as someone important in that way. I'm curious how you first got to know about Jan.
Yeah, it was first just his name that I made a film previously called All Against All, and we used fragments of the NSB, the Dutch Nazi Party propaganda films. And I knew that he was one of the directors involved. And it was only after making that film that we came across interviews, like hours, almost 8 hours of sound interview with Jan Teunissen from the 1960s. And I only read about these interviews, then we started looking for them, and luckily we found them. They were reserved and archived, and we started listening to the tapes, me and the researcher I've worked with, Rick Binnendijk, and we just fell off our chairs of the way he talks about what he did during the war and his decision to collaborate, but also the things he made, and especially like really boasting about his friendships with Goebbels and Himmler and these kind of party members. But and I think one of the themes that interested me most during All Against All was propaganda, and also the effects that propaganda has on public opinion and how it can really poison also public opinion and democracy. And yeah, obviously that resonates also a lot in our current time. So this was a topic that I thought was interesting as a start for our film. And then the other thing is that we found all the family films. So in the 1920s and 1930s, he came from a rich family. So he had the means to make home movies at a time that nobody actually made home movies. So he shot his footage of his family in and around the house on 35 millimeter. And these are in itself are actually really nice or interesting documents. But the two combined, where you see this family life combined with the interviews about what he did during the war and his role as his nickname was the Film Tsar. So he was the most powerful man in Dutch film, in the Dutch film industry during the war. That was the like the starting point for this film.
With all the material that you've gone through, I can imagine that it's hours and hours and hours of really getting to know a man who yeah. you, throughout the process, you have to sort of also decide, like, you know, what am I even hearing? Like, sometimes some things that he's saying in the film also are really, they blow you off your chair.
Yeah.
And I can imagine that in some way you have the feeling that you know him quite intimately. And it is interesting, I think, comparing it to the previous film that you made, which is Gerlach, a film that you made about a farmer who is living close to Amsterdam, who you also feel that you know a man in a very intimate way. But these must have been two completely opposite processes. I'm curious to know how it was after, you know, really being inside the life of one man to then being also inside the life of a man without ever being able to shake his hand.
Yeah. And actually, we did make them in a parallel way also. So I already started The Propagandist in 2020. And the Gerlach with Aliona van der Horst, the co-director, we started, I think, in 2018, but was also a process of many years following him. And so they were, like you say, really opposite kind of characters, where with Gerlach you feel this like humanity and this just interpersonal relation with friends that are heartwarming and also dealing with life in a way that is humbling, you know, and with all the tragedy in his personal life that he went through and just dealing with this and still being a friendly person and not being resentful towards life and towards other people. And then Jan Teunis, who is really in many ways the exact opposite, who is out there to take revenge, you feel in many ways. Like he made this big feature film before the war called Willem van Oranje, like a Dutch Birth of a Nation kind of project, I think he must have had in his mind, but it became like a really horrible flop. And mm-hmm. it was written, how do you say, in the grond geschreven, like it was really
burned to the ground.
Yeah, by critics. And then from that point on, you feel that what motivates him is not only what he says himself, like, yeah, I just wanted to get Dutch film cinema going and Dutch cinema from the ground. You feel that he always wants, so has this kind of resentful feeling that he wants to take revenge for this failure and doesn't really, he externalizes this failure, I think, towards society and all the people that were against him. And when we were editing, we edited for a long time, and at some point you get used a little bit to his way of talking. And also the first contact or the first experience you have with the interview, it mellows down a little bit your reaction. But what I did do in the last couple of weeks of editing before we locked the picture, I listened to all the tapes again, because also a little bit neurotically just don't want to miss anything important, but also to get a feeling a little again, like, who is this man? And this was quite chilling, I must say. It's like looking into a big depth of emptiness also. Like the things that he says in the film are horrible, but on the tapes there are so many more of these horrible things where he basically rationalizes the Holocaust in many ways. Like he says, yeah, if you have a totalitarian state, of course you need to pick your enemies that are causing trouble. And it's like, yeah, but you're part of it. Like, he doesn't see his own role in it.
No, he's in absolute denial of what he does. It's also very special to listen to how a mind like that works.
Yeah.
But one thing that I find very beautiful and special in your film is that there's quite some moments where I, to some extent, I understand where he's coming from, because you start your film off with this very beautiful home video material that he shot, which is truthfully very beautifully made, and you, through those videos, also really understand that he's trying to sort of discover this medium, and you understand his love for cinema, which, as someone who loves cinema, I see where he's coming from.
Yeah.
And that is also quite special, that's someone who you may be able to call a devil in some way or another also has a heart for something that I can fully understand.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know if this passion for cinema is something that maybe in some way also connected you to him in throughout the process, or maybe when you started making this film.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think many filmmakers share this, if you put it positively, it's this love for cinema. But then there is also a part of cinema that is quite opportunistic, where you need funds and you need to create this persona that is friendly and nice to work with, and it has an opportunistic side. And I feel that he is like this part of the filmmaker has radicalized with him, where at some point he didn't care at all where the money comes from. He's just working towards his own goals. So I think it, in a classical sense, he is this Faustian figure that wants to make art, but then sells his soul to go to any length to make films. And but I think it's, yeah, he starts out with these a couple of really nice films and intimate films, where a little bit in the style of Joris Ivens and these filmmakers that came just before him. But also when you listen to him, it feels to me that he wants to become a filmmaker more than he wants to make films.
Interesting.
So he's trying to be part of this history of filmmakers, and wants to be part of like an art history. That's what I feel. He wants to be an important filmmaker, even more than just make films. And that's also how you look at the pictures. Sometimes he poses with these scarves around his neck, and he really looks like this auteur, and he's pretentious also. This kind of guy.
Interesting.
In some way, this question, when does your own ambition start to work against the people around you? When does it become egoistic and it doesn't help anybody but yourself? I think that's a good question that also, even in my life, I ask myself sometimes, why am I doing this? No, there is a part that is really, you need to be somewhat obsessive to finish a film even, because I remember the first times just finishing a film, it was quite shocking to me how much work it took. And compared to, I also played in bands, but it felt to me that being in a band was much more relaxed than finishing a film, which is crazy. All the details and at some point nobody cares anymore except for you. I mean, when you're starting out, luckily now there are more people invested, but.
That is true. Yeah. And that's maybe also why I see a small bit of myself in Jan Teunisse, where I see there's some part of Cuckoo where you have a passion for something that nobody around you sees where you're going, but you have to go there in some way or another. Yeah.
Yet this Adorno, the sociologist, he had an F scale for fascism. So he would say if somebody did a test, you could rate really high on the F scale, and then you were almost like full-blown fascist. And you could make like a T scale, though, for filmmakers, how high you rate on this Teunisse scale of like radicalized opportunism. I think I would be quite conscious of where the money comes from, and I mean, it's easy to say from here, from my privileged position, not having to make these kind of decisions, but I think I wouldn't take the path he went on.
No, it's easier when you think of it in the times of now.
Yeah.
I was thinking about it this morning also, like, who would know? Maybe if I would have lived during this time, I would have also crossed boundaries that I would now, you know, that I stand by. But then I thought, no, in this political climate, I think I would not make the same decisions.
No,
I would be pretty sure. This process of making this film has been different, I think, from every other film that you've made before, where you, of course, you did shoot material, but it is only a small part of what the entire film was. I'm curious to know if that process has been very different for you, where the material was mostly already there rather than having to find or look for it in the world.
Yeah, I started out with this ideal in my head that I would make a simple film with just archive and just the interview. And then working on it, at some point I felt the need to do some extra filming myself. And one of the things was that I just looking around, I found that some of the buildings that he lived in his life were still there. And I just felt that there was a need also in the editing to get a different kind of tempo for the film than the film, the shots that he made himself. So the problem with editing was that all the films that they made, many of the films that they made, had these really short shots, like 3-second shots.
Mm.
And to really listen to his voice and not to be distracted by all the cuts in the image, I was looking for ways to slow down the tempo, where you get this feeling of, somebody mentioned slowly cooking off water, this feeling that you're around somebody who's at first maybe not like an evil guy, but then turns out to be in the end. I think it helped the editing mostly that we did extra footage apart from the film that he shot himself. And for example, the buildings were there, but also the historians that made the recordings, the sound recordings of the interviews with the filmmakers that you hear in the film, they are still both alive. And I was also looking for a way to counter Teunis's story, although subtly, not making this big command like, yeah, he's evil. I mean, we know this, hopefully, like the viewer will know that this is a bad guy, but just to react to some of the things that he says. And I really liked just during the research, I saw the face also of the historians when they listen back to the recordings.
Mm.
So you get this indirect emotion of what you can feel yourself through, like the faces of the historians. Yeah.
Yeah, true. Also, because after a while you do indeed get used to sort of this absurd way of speaking.
Yeah.
That sometimes you need someone else to tell you that it is absurd what he is saying. That's true.
And that there is another perspective, or that there is an outside of his own story. Yeah.
One thing that I thought was quite brilliant by the end of the film is that you see that Jan Teunis, after the war, he delves into a more commercial approach of filmmaking. And it really awakened a light in me to understand how the processes of propaganda are in some way very clearly linked to how propaganda was originally made and was then used in a more commercial or capital context.
Yeah.
Was that something that you learned from Jan Teunisse and through his career? Or I'm curious to know what your decision-making was upon putting it to ending the story in that way.
Yeah, I think listening to the interviews with these men and finding out that they were all involved in industrial and advertising, industrial films and advertising after the war, that brought the idea like, oh, there is a continuation. And as you say, it's the same thing. And they, at some point, they didn't use the word propaganda anymore. They changed it for advertising, but it is the same thing. And I think also if you listen to what sometimes filmmakers are asked, why did you make a commercial for this and that? And they get into the same kind of language that Teunis is also talking in when he talks about his collaboration. So it's also about like not really taking responsibility. If I don't do it, somebody else will do it. And but it was interesting just to see also the kind of films that they made were, for example, for KLM and for airplanes and for like the big container ships, for Shell and these kind of companies that you think are causing many of the problems we are today in. And also the, like the invention of clichés. And that started, of course, before fascism, but it is a continuation when you look at the films of Reinier Meyer, who was involved in these NSB propaganda films or Nederland film. He films these windmills and an image of the Netherlands, like this romantic image of water. And then after the war, he makes these tourist films about Amsterdam and attracting American tourists to come to the Netherlands. And he uses the same images. And he says it himself. It's basically the same film as I did in 1942. And I used the same music. And yeah. And I think it has to do also with this, just finding the clichés in culture that will work best on an emotional level. And tulips and windmills, where when we see it, we'll be like, okay, there we go again. No, but then apparently it works for the rest of the world and it works as a symbol.
I would say that I have some understanding of what propaganda is and how it works, because it's something you learn in school, maybe. But I'm curious if also within the current political climate that we're in, if the making of this film has changed your perspective on the mechanism of propaganda.
Well, you see the same tricks being used over and over again. And that's part of the success of certain rhetorical tricks, is that it keeps repeating itself. So like the whole image that they build up of the Netherlands with this, like the seafarers, but also the windmills and all these images are being repeated endlessly also in our current days. And of course, the dark side of it is like, at one side, you're creating this romantic image of the Netherlands, but at the same time, you're preparing people to point out who is not part of it and saying these are the ones that are not part of our gezellig country. And so there are a lot of books also written about this, but how the same tricks are being used over and over again. And I think it's not getting any less, it's even getting more at this point. And I feel just after the war, there were a lot of studies being done, for example, by Adorno, where they try to really reach out to people and educate people on how propaganda works. And so for a long time after the war, it must have felt that this is something from the past, no? This kind of national socialist way of creating hate on one side and creating this idealized romantic vision on the other side. And now it has come back with a vengeance. It has been coming back, of course, for decades, but now it feels like all...
The gates have opened.
Yeah.
It is quite a bleak image that indeed is maybe growing only more and more. But do you think that there is a way in which propaganda can be used in a more positive light, or maybe in a more in a hopeful direction?
Yeah, it's a difficult question, because also when you're making documentaries like myself, I try to believe that I am reflecting on reality more than really manipulating people's minds to go in a certain direction. And that is the association I have with propaganda. But of course, if you are working for a political party or you have a green agenda, I think you should use propaganda to get your message through. And not all propaganda is negative in that sense. If you keep close to the truth, I think this was one of the rules of the Brits during the Second World War, is that they said propaganda is okay, but our propaganda should be truthful. And that were lessons that they learned from the First World War, where they kind of invented a lot of modern propaganda techniques also based on just lies, and lying all the time about the enemy. And Hitler and the National Socialists, they looked to this British propaganda a lot for inspiration and just for techniques. And also studying, like, it's known that Goebbels, for example, had a book by Bernard who was this nephew of Freud, and he was writing about these new techniques of psychological influence that you can help you with advertisement. So yeah, I think you could use propaganda in the right way, but there is no textbook for it because it depends, of course, on what you believe is the right thing to do. Or and also, I think, because before I was saying about this movie that you don't want to influence reality, but I think that's also not true because media always influence reality and also your own role as a filmmaker. Sometimes you are a little bit activist and you do want reality to change or situations to change or at least change something in the minds of people. So it's not a clear distinction, but I think with Teunissen, you just feel that he is he doesn't care about reality or the truth anymore, that he is cynical about the truth and it's just like, okay, we need to do this to win the war and this kind of thing. He's really weaponizing all the powers of media.
Yeah, and also not willing to see the truth in any way or another, avoiding it.
Yeah. Even.
Yeah. Maybe that is not Teunissen, but what you said earlier, also a nice way to sort of go towards the final question of the interview by asking you what your hopes for the future are. And that's a broad question that you may answer in the way you wish.
I will give a different answer in the morning than in the evening, I'm afraid. No, these are not really hopeful times, but then, of course, people are resilient and there are always people that react in ways that are surprising. And so we'll see how this turns out. But at the moment, of course, things are not looking too bright, which in many ways it's also surprising if you grew up, as I did, like from the 1980s on certain themes. For example, racism, it felt for a long time that these like really racist, seeing racist people that are overtly racist, it felt like remnants of the past. And this has turned around a little bit, like not a little bit, like a big bit. Sorry, how am I going to make this? No, that it's so, it came back so strong, yeah. Like, and so purposeful and so powerful, and that is really scary.
Yeah, yeah.
Not saying anything new
within the context of propaganda, I think it's also, I really strongly now realize how misused the idea of inclusion has been used within the context of commercial image to really use it in such a refined surface level that we live in an inclusive world.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah, fundamentally it's changed absolutely nothing.
No, and also that's been so successful, that some people are really capable with big budgets to influence opinions and really put out this a lot of disinformation and really these narratives that are having a lot of impact. And that's something that I found interesting also, like recent studies show this, that you might think that, for example, this anti-immigration sentiments come up in certain times and it has been related to poverty or unemployment, but that in a lot of cases is really not the case. It's like these breeding grounds are being fed by propaganda. They are being created, so they don't necessarily come out of people's opinions or feelings of about what's happening in reality, but they really react to this propagandistic narrative, and that makes it difficult also to control and to follow what's happening also even around you. And I have two kids, and if I look at what they see on their phones, you're really shocked sometimes, like, how, why are they seeing this? For example, these Tate brothers, they keep coming back. And they keep coming back, and you're like, "How? What filters are there left to
kick them out?"
Yeah. So. Oof.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that your film can offer some perspective, also on our current times.
Thanks.
If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to watch The Propagandists, now playing in cinemas.
And don't forget to book tickets to our next Celebrating Cinema Film Club screening of Everything Everywhere All at Once on the 24th of April. Tickets for that are in the show notes. Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. Do you love what we do? Support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. And don't forget to check the show notes for all the films mentioned, bonus info, and ticket links. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzall and artwork from Studio FFF.